Call the next case.
Collins versus Commonwealth. W. McMillan Powers, Assistant Public Defender, Appellate Counsel. John I. Jones, the Fourth Assistant Attorney General, Appellate Counsel.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is McMillan Powers, and I represent Raekwon Collins in this matter, in which he was convicted of statutory burglary and grand larceny. The facts in this case are very simple. Ms. Bland's home was burglarized, and a number of items were taken, including three televisions, which really are the focus of the trial, the televisions. Two officers responded, Martinez and Fitzsimmons. They came on the call of suspicious characters running through the neighborhood. That was their call, not to a break-in, but just some people running through the neighborhood carrying items. Martinez responds to that call, goes to Cole Court in Portsmouth, at which time he finds on the curb, or between the curb and the sidewalk, three television sets out there in the open at about 7:30 at night. He responds about an hour and a half after Mrs. Bland has left her home, in which she later testified was locked and secured and that sort of thing.
How long was it after the telephone call?
There's no information about that in the record. He responded at 7:22, I think is what the record actually says. It doesn't really say when that was dispatched. That's when he responded. So there's an hour and a half between the time she left her home and the time he responds. So we don't really know when the burglary occurred. Obviously, there was a burglary because the door was kicked in, and items that she owned were found in Cole Court. She lives at Welcome Road. The two properties share a backyard. There's a cul-de-sac, Cole Court, and the property where she lives at Welcome backs up to Cole Court, which is where the televisions were found. Evidence technician came to the scene eventually and did a fingerprint search, lifted a bunch of latent prints, most of which were so smeared or just not usable. The fingerprint technician did, however, get a couple of good prints, and Robin Lant, who was the fingerprint technician from the crime lab, came and testified that two of the prints, these two fingers, the index and middle finger of the left hand of the defendant, matched a prints on one of the televisions. That was the sum and substance of the evidence. And our position is that based on the law in this court, when you have fingerprint evidence only, you have to have some other circumstance that kind of puts the case together and actually proves that the client, my client, stole these items. There is no other evidence. The cases that this court has decided, Avent, Turner, and Tyler, the three cases that really point the line here, are very much cases where there is other evidence. In Avent, you've got all sorts of other evidence that talks about why the defendant was guilty. The manager of the store said he never worked there, he never had any business being in there, and the broken window where his prints were found were 7 feet above the street level. So the only way he could have accidentally gotten there would have been if he was a window washer and he fell. But that was obviously, there was no other explanation. So in Avent, the fingerprint that's found is found in a very unique and unusual place. Avent cites a McNeil case, and McNeil is a Maryland case in which a business is broken into, safe is damaged, machines are messed up, and money is taken, all sorts of things like that. Most importantly, 11 bottles of whiskey are taken. And the key piece of evidence there was that the defendant's fingerprint was found on a beer bottle sitting right next to the safe that had been damaged during the burglary. So you have the kind of evidence that puts the defendant in that location very uniquely right in the middle of the crime scene. In the Turner case, a bloody fingerprint is found impressed into the flashlight found in the bedroom of the murder victim. So you've got more evidence than just the fingerprint. And then, of course, finally, in the Tyler case, this is a children's store that's broken into. And once again, the owner of the store says the defendant never worked there, had no legitimate business being there, had never been in the store. And the fingerprints there are found on broken glass, both sides of broken glass, five different pieces that are neatly laid up against the wall inside and outside the building. They're neatly laid up there, broken but laid up, and fingerprints that match the defendant on both sides of the glass five times. In this case, the only evidence is two fingerprints on a television located in a public place at least an hour and a half after the potential burglary. I mean, it could not have been any more time than an hour and a half. So sometime in that hour and a half, those items are taken and they're placed there on the side. There's no eyewitness. No one came forward and identified the defendant as the person running through the neighborhood carrying any items. No one identified him at being at the house that was burglarized. No DNA, no fingerprints, no evidence from the burglarized residence was introduced because there wasn't any. It was just a kicked-in door and disappeared items, later recovered. That's the sum and substance of the evidence against my client. That evidence is not enough to line up with Turner and Tyler and Avid. We learned long ago in just plain geometry that 3 points make a straight line. And I think we got 3 points here. You've got Avent, you've got Turner, you've got Tyler. And you have incriminating evidence placing the defendant in each of those cases at the crime scene. Here you don't have incriminating evidence. You have two pieces of evidence, the two fingerprints, in a public place. The cases go on and talk about one of the things you need to consider is the context in which the prints are found. In those cases that this court's already decided, those prints are found in the worst possible place for the defendant to pursue any reasonable hypothesis of innocence. The Attorney General makes an issue that in this case, we didn't present any evidence to support a hypothesis of innocence, and therefore this court does not have to even get to that issue. In Avent, Turner, Tyler, and McNeil, the case that was relied upon in Avent, defendants presented no evidence, did not testify, no evidence, except in Turner, where a lady testified, I let the defendant sleep in my house the night of the murder. And that was the only evidence in the Turner case for the defendant. So in all of those cases, the defendant did not present any evidence because he rests on his presumption of innocence. For this court or for the trial court to say, some evidence has been presented, two fingerprints, and now you have to come forward with evidence to prove your innocence is contrary to everything that we understand criminal law to be about. First and principally, the presumption of innocence and the requirement that the Commonwealth reach the standard of reasonable doubt.
But honestly, the Court of Appeals and the trial court didn't do that in so many words. But your point is still well taken. If the hypothesis of innocence arises out of the Commonwealth's case, then it's already in the case.
It is in the case. And I think for the trial court to say that I've got to do something more just doesn't seem, not only doesn't seem right, it is not right. The presumption is there. My client stands innocent until the final verdict. He is innocent till then. And so when the evidence comes in, unless you have the Turner case where your bloody thumbprint is on a flashlight in the murder victim's bedroom, I think I now have some burden to come forward with evidence. If my fingerprints are on both sides of five pieces of glass stacked neatly against a wall at the place that was burglarized, I think I have to come forward.
Isn't the best way to say what you're saying that you don't have to say anything, you don't have to carry any burden, but you can't rely upon a hypothesis of innocence that's not in the record? So if it's not in the Commonwealth's evidence, you can't imagine it yourself and throw it out there.
The case law clearly says it cannot spring from the imagination of the fertile minds of...
But your hypothesis here is it sat there for an hour and 22 minutes and the kid could have walked up and picked it up and said, and walked away.
He could have, but the evidence of the Commonwealth in this case is it's these two fingers. So it's obvious that the best the evidence shows is he touched it. It does not show that he grasped it because, fortunately, we have opposable digit thumbs. He did not grasp it, so he did not carry it based on the evidence that the Commonwealth presented. He could have Arguably, they could have presented some other kind of evidence that he carried it, an eyewitness. There's no evidence in the testimony as to when he was even arrested. So we don't know when they found the defendant that night, a week later, a month later. There's no evidence as to when he was arrested, when he became a suspect. He's never found with any of the other goods that were stolen from Ms. Bland's home. So it just seems that at this point, there is no evidence that connects him to either the burglary or to the larceny of those goods. Finally, just on the idea that the Attorney General makes the point that the recent possession of stolen goods gives rise to a presumption of guilt of the larceny and all that sort of thing. And then goes on to say you can also go from there to burglary. But in the case that the Attorney General cites, and I do just want to bring that out in Gwynn, where they talk about you can have a possession, someone broke in the house, that the goods were stolen, and that the goods were then in the possession of the defendant. The key thing there is you add the idea of possession by the defendant, and here the defendant never has possession, so no presumptions ever rise to aid the Commonwealth in any case. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, if I may.
All right.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I am John Jones, and I represent the Commonwealth, and we are asking the Court to affirm Collins' convictions because the evidence was sufficient to establish that he was the criminal actor that broke into Ms. Bland's home and stole her televisions. This case does turn on whether the evidence reasonably excluded the possibility that Collins innocently placed his fingerprints on these televisions. What's not at issue is whether he possessed them in the sense that he never had an opportunity before Ms. Bland left for the night at 6 o'clock or after sometime before 7:22 when the neighbor began to watch the televisions.
May I interrupt you for a second?
Yes,
sir. The fingerprints, are you inferring or saying the fact finder could infer from the fingerprints that at some point in time he actually possessed the TV itself?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that that inference is justified by the evidence, and that's just to say that in the sense that he exercised dominion and control over them, that at some point, while they were free of Ms. Bland's home, he touched them. I don't know whether he picked them up or not. There is evidence of the location of the fingerprints. It's on the corner, on the right edge of the television. That would seem to indicate that carrying was more likely than inspection, but obviously that's just another circumstance that goes into the totality of the evidence that was before the fact.
But have any of the recent possession cases been built entirely upon a fingerprint or two, as opposed to actual evidence of true physical possession?
I don't know that any of the cases of recent possession have. However, Your Honor, I don't know that that's dispositive, because here there's no question that he did possess them, that he was there and touched the televisions within a very well-defined time frame. And so if once the Commonwealth had made that, established that fact, I think that the Commonwealth can rely on the recent possession.
Is touching possessing?
I believe so, Your Honor, yes. And again, when identity is established by fingerprints, other circumstances must exclude that innocent placement hypothesis.
Walk me through how touching is possessing.
Yes,
support that.
Okay. I guess I would just rely on the plain language argument that to come up and to touch without anyone else around would be evidence of possession. I don't mean to say that he certainly carried it, but to exercise dominion control over that chattel that he didn't have ownership of, that's what the evidence supports.
An instantaneous touch with two fingers indicate dominion and control. Is there a case that says that?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Seems like a little bit of a stretch.
What the evidence did establish was that in this well-defined and short time frame, someone took this television out of Ms. Bland's home.
Yes.
And then someone called the police indicating that individuals were running through the neighborhood carrying things in a suspicious manner. From that point, Martinez and Fitzsimmons were dispatched, and they were flagged down by a neighbor who pointed them toward the televisions. And so the time frame is just not sufficient for... we have from...
So there were multiple people involved.
Yes.
And we know that at least one of them exercised dominion and control.
Yes, sir.
We know that another one apparently touched it.
We know that Collins touched it.
And is the presence of two fingerprints consistent with running through the neighborhood while carrying the television?
The presence of two fingerprints that were useful for identification is consistent with the idea of running and
were there other fingerprints that kind of indicated that somebody may have been like holding it and carrying it?
There were,
but we can only identify two?
Yes, Your Honor. There were a number of fingerprints, and if you go through the fingerprint cards that Sissel had created...
Where in the record am I going to find fingerprint, illegible fingerprint evidence that is consistent with holding and carrying?
If you look at the series of fingerprint cards toward the end of the record... beginning on page 120, Your Honor, and following from there, that's the series of fingerprint cards that Sissel created, and you can see the X's on the sketches on all of the even-numbered pages. That indicates where the fingerprints were. You don't have fingerprints in the middle of the... there are a number of fingerprints, and they all tend to be around the edges as one would carry a television. Many of them were not useful for identification, Your Honor. And you can look at...
Right, something is smeared or whatever, you can't really lift a clean print.
Yes, Your Honor. And there was also testimony from Sissel about that.
Okay. And you've answered my question.
Okay.
The Court of Appeals seemed to rely rather heavily on the recent possession of stolen goods, giving rise to an inference of the breaking and entering. From that location. If we decide that two fingerprints on a television set is insufficient to establish possession, it would appear to me that the Commonwealth's case is over because the Court of Appeals doesn't rely on anything else.
If those fingerprints are not sufficient to establish possession, Your Honor, you're absolutely right. Those are the only things that connect the defendant in this case to the goods that were stolen. However, the
two... I've not seen you here before, but I can tell you what, you're starting out on the right foot. That's a very candid response to the court, and I thank you for it.
Thank you, Your Honor. But at any rate, the evidence in taken in its totality was sufficient to support the idea that those fingerprints, because those fingerprints show that Collins touched the television at some point very close in proximity to the burglary. And so at that point, I think the Commonwealth has made the prima facie case to establish the identity of the thief. And the other evidence, the other circumstances...
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Yes,
Jones. Sure. But the word possession is a little ambiguous, but whenever we use that with possession with intent or anything like that, we almost always add dominion and control because it adds more color to what we're talking about. You know, dominion and control is this. Dominion and control is not that, right? So... when you use the term possession, are you thinking dominion and control, or are you thinking some relationship with the object less than that?
I believe that dominion and control is sufficient. I believe...
I'm giving you that for the purpose of the question, and I think you're right, actually.
Yes, Your Honor.
Dominion and control is certainly sufficient. I guess the question is, are you saying that touching something is sufficient to establish what we would ordinarily call dominion and control.
In the totality of the other circumstances that the evidence of that touch was found in, I think so, Your Honor.
Am I correct? This is a residential area.
Yes.
It's a cul-de-sac.
It's a cul-de-sac.
So it's not a high-traffic area where say in a shopping mall or, a busy street.
Yes, Your
Honor. It's in the evening.
Yes.
And it's in a limited time frame.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the question is it a reasonable inference for a fact finder when there are these two fingerprints to say, well, either he's the thief or was involved in it, or he casually happened to stroll by, and as one might, if you see a nice new TV or whatever sitting there, you might say, oh, let me check this out. Those are really the two paths.
Yes.
And so it's a question of where the line is drawn for a reasonable hypothesis of innocence.
Yes, Your Honor. I agree wholeheartedly. That's a very succinct statement of the Commonwealth's position. And there are some other circumstances also that tend to point toward that he was the criminal actor in this. One thing that the Commonwealth noted after it submitted his brief was that his fingerprints were only on one television. It wasn't the largest one either. One would expect that if he was just coming up here laying his hands on it to inspect it, that he wouldn't just be interested in the one television, but perhaps all three. And this one of the smaller televisions was where they found his fingerprints. They didn't find them on the larger, the 46-inch, I believe, Samsung, or the other Samsung television.
Can I ask you another question before you run out of time? Can you respond to the defendant's argument that the placement of the fingerprints don't have corresponding fingerprint grip evidence based upon the location of them? Do you dispute that, or do you concede that, or what's the answer?
I would concede that there wasn't a thumbprint that was lifted that was consistent with Collins's thumb. However, I don't know how far that gets you. Obviously, the evidence could have been better in this case, Your Honor. And it's not the Commonwealth's position that this is a
model. Well, these are two fingerprints exactly where on the box?
On the right side, on the right corner.
Okay, so you got two fingerprints in the right corner. Is there any print at all where the thumb would be if those two fingerprints...
I don't know that the record speaks to that, Your Honor. And what we really have is not all the fingerprints that were on the televisions, but rather the ones that Sissel took from them and his rather rudimentary sketches of where he took them from. That's not to say that anything that looked like a print he took, and it also doesn't give us...
I guess what I'm asking is, are there any incomplete or blurred any fingerprints of any kind, identifiable or not, that would otherwise be where a thumbprint would be if you were gripping the thing?
There were a number of fingerprint cards, Your Honor. I can't give you a yes or no answer as I stand here before you. I would be happy to submit supplemental briefing on that point.
Sorry, we'll look at it.
There were a number of cards that were associated with the Sharp television, though, and those are found on pages 130, 136, 138, 140, and 142 in their sketches as to the locations of all the prints that were taken on those cards. So, but if I could just summarize all the additional circumstances that pointed toward Collins's guilt here.
Well, before you do that, could you address appellant's argument that the recently possessed goods is not good enough for statutory burglary, even if it is good enough for grand larceny? Because you collapsed that in your brief.
Yes, sure.
Counsel makes a distinction.
And in Guyne, it says on page 480, the Commonwealth can establish a prima facie case that a defendant broke and entered by, one, proving that goods have been stolen from a house into which someone broke and entered, two, justifying the inference that both offenses were committed at the same time. I believe both of those are undisputed on this record. And three, proving that these goods were found soon thereafter in the possession of the defendant. So if the Commonwealth can't establish from the fingerprints that recent possession prong, then we wouldn't be able to establish the burglary. But if the Commonwealth if the court were to accept that that can be proven by circumstantial evidence, which is just another word for these fingerprints, it's circumstantial evidence, then I believe we do get both the burglary and the larceny, Your Honor. So, and just to run down a list, it's not just the fingerprints on the television. That's not the only evidence that was there. There was evidence of other circumstances. You have the time frame. You have the very short distance. They share backyards. You have the fact that it is a cul-de-sac in a residential area, which is a lot lower traffic than, say, 9th and Broad at lunchtime. And the neighbor that was in the neighborhood of 9 Cole Court, who apparently called the police, we don't know that it was the same neighbor, but we do know that a neighbor called the police to say there's people running through, and that at some point, pretty soon thereafter, Martinez and Fitzsimmons show up, and another neighbor points them directly to the televisions. So that wipes out that tail end of the time frame, however long that was between the call and the officers arriving, for someone to have innocently come by and just said, oh, that's interesting, it's a television. The location of the prints on the television, again, it's just a circumstance. I believe that that is consistent with carrying, though, on the right side.
I'm sorry, before you end, can we find out the exact time of the call?
It's not in the record that I can tell, Your Honor.
So we got 6 p.m., the homeowner leaving. We got 7:22 approximately of the officers on scene, securing the scene.
Yes, Your Honor.
So we don't know where that... We don't exactly know the fact pattern in between those two polls, do we?
We don't, except to say that it's less than an hour and 22 minutes.
Okay.
All right, because it would take time to break in, to rummage through, carry out.
Yes, Your Honor. And without more evidence on the record, I can't say how long the break-in took or how long that it was between the call and when the police actually showed up, but we do know that that cut time from both the beginning and the end of that total window in which all these things must have happened. And the tighter that that window gets, the less likely the hypothesis of innocence is. And I just add one more thing. The standard review is very important in this case, and if I may conclude briefly, Your Honor, that the standard isn't whether this court would have found as the fact finder did. It's whether any reasonable fact finder could have found and rejected that hypothesis of innocence. And the Commonwealth's position is that it could have.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal.
Yes, very briefly, let me just address a couple of things. As to the Gwynn case, which the Attorney General has cited to, that case is a very brief per curiam opinion, and all of the justices of that court are not here now. There are no justices now currently sitting. Not that that makes any difference, but it does not reference, in that opinion, the Walters case, the Williams case, or the Fields case, all of which are cited in the brief, for the proposition that recent possession does not lead to that presumption of burglary. It does not address any of those cases, which some of which were recent just before the Gwynn case was decided. So I think the Gwynn case, with all due respect to that bench that was deciding that case, I don't think it's the most soundly reasoned case that that bench ever produced. And I don't think
it
addresses
those.
None of the justices currently sitting were on that bench. But I don't think that it addresses the other cases immediately on point. And I think for that reason, Gwynn is completely distinguishable. In addition, talking about the time frame, let me just address that again. You've got an hour and 22 minutes. We know that's the approximate time. Ms. Lane says she left around 6. The officer arrives at 7:22. No idea in the record. It does not tell us when the phone call is made to the police. It does not. We don't know who's running through the neighborhood. We don't know if they were running at 6:05 or at 7:20. There's no evidence of that. If the call came earlier, say 6:15, then there would have been a lot of time for someone to have walked by and touched the television. If the call came later, there would have been equally as much time for someone to have touch the television, because not everyone sees everything. So someone could have just as easily gone through the cul-de-sac prior to the phone call and touched it. So I don't think that the time frame really advances the Commonwealth's position one way or the other on that. And as to whether or not it's the smallest TV or the largest TV, there were other items taken, including a laptop and an iPod phone and some tennis shoes. There were other items taken. Whoever was carrying items could easily have just taken those and left all these other things, so that what is there left for the defendant to touch are just the TVs. And so he touches a TV. And then he sees somebody now making a phone call, or maybe he now sees the police arriving. We don't know what happens. And he moves immediately before he can ever touch the other two TVs. Who knows? He may have been doing early Christmas shopping at the discount curb store on December the 4th. No, there's just no evidence of that. And based on the fact that there's no evidence, we cannot overcome the presumption of innocence. The whole idea of possession versus access, I think, is critical to this case. I think the bench, I think Your Honors fully understand that access to something is not necessarily the same as possession. Otherwise, we're all going to have real problems. And then finally, I would just say that the jurisprudence from this court is very clear that suspicion, however significant the suspicion may be, however great, is not sufficient to overcome the presumption of innocence and to prove beyond reasonable doubt someone is guilty unless you've got some corroborating evidence to these fingerprints. But I ask that you would reverse and dismiss. Thank you.
Call the next